at Patty Mocha chanting today, this afternoon, Ajahn Yanako was giving a bit of a owada about, just we usually do that at the Patty Mocha time, and he was mentioning that he had the sense that the plane that we're all flying in was starting to come in for a landing for winter retreat, beginning the descent into winter retreat. I think I'm a little bit behind that. I'm still kind of cruising at a pretty high altitude, but looking forward to the approaching descent. It's been a very full-on bit of time since, including and since returning from our Thanksgiving retreat. As probably most, but maybe not all of you know, we're in the process of, it's looking like we're closing in on purchasing another piece of property right across the street. Our good friend and board treasurer, Mark, is selling his home, moving back to the Bay Area. And as it was just about to come onto the market, we started to realize that this might be an opportunity that we should really look into for helping to have a place to care for our aging and infirm monastics as we move into older age. Looking forward a bit, because it's not something we've really done a lot of planning for. Really, since we've been here, we've always acknowledged that it's something we'll have to think about at some point, but been so busy just trying to get these basic structures, this cloister area and amenities, cabins up in the forest. And now, as these have been completed, the notion that we really should be looking towards the future care for people who can't walk up a steep slope for 25 minutes to get to their kuti. It's not going to be too long before some of us, anyway, are going to be not able to do that so easily. And possibly even, probably even, needing to have something that's accessible and a place where we can be on one level and sit in our wheelchairs and drool and hopefully have some friends clean it up, to be graphic. can't say I'm looking forward to it, but I'm expecting it. Hopefully people will be nice to me. But as we were thinking about this and starting to investigate some of the restrictions that we have with our use permit, we've maxed out on the number of facilities that we can build on this property that have bathrooms. And our use permit will not allow any anymore, which is kind of an obstacle if you're looking to try and care for some older people. So as we've been considering what to do, the mind also looks at other properties outside of this particular property that's not covered by the use permit, and keeping our ears and eyes open for those possibilities. And lo and behold, this property, with Mark leaving, in fact, I think he left today, actually, to make his move down to Spirit Rock. The house came open, and we thought, wow, this is a good time to do it. And, of course, a large part of the picture was, can we afford it? Because we pretty much only had about half the money for the cost of it, and could put that down, but would have to borrow on a long-term, a short-term loan, but probably at least 5 years, the rest of the money to make it happen. And just weighing that, the consequences, the effect of that. And as that was being considered, without going into a very long story about how it all happened, a very generous anonymous donor who we haven't even met here, but who has connections with other communities in our tradition, happened to be making some offers to help other monasteries and wanted to help us as well fit some of his goals for supporting the Ajahn Chah communities, and particularly the goals of wanting to make sure that facilities are available for caring for older and infirm monks as part of the objective. And basically, you know, I shouldn't probably say this, particularly since it's being recorded, but it looks like we will be able to buy the place. We've put in an offer, and the very generous donor is wanting to offer the entire cost of it. So, you know, we're all kind of reeling with, and, you know, just appreciation and gratitude that this is, looks like it's going to be happening, barring some major obstructions that that maybe we haven't seen for some reason, but there's a few things that we'll have to take care of in terms of fixing up some broken things, but by and large, it looks like it's going to happen. Particularly thanks to the generosity of this this person. So, involved myself particularly, I think, and other members of the community as well, and certainly our board president, Paul, spending lots of time going through the hoops that one goes through in doing all of this. So I'm still feeling a bit up there in the stratosphere, spending many hours in the office working with this, but also with a very strong sense of joy and appreciation. This is the kind of thing that if one is going to spend one's time working on things like this, that this is it. This is the way to do it, and this is the thing to be involved with. It just brings up such a sense of goodness. So as we hopefully we'll be starting our descent soon as things settle down. The qualities of the winter, if I look around closely enough at my environment and the signals from the change of season into more dark and cool, and we've had a little taste of rain, that the mind starts to, has the potential, at least, for starting to settle and gather with a more inward focus. And that as we start to finish up duties, finish up projects, there's still a lot going on, but it seems like they're all progressing well and in a timely way, that the natural tendency, if it follows the course of past years, is to start to gather and move inwards in preparation for the winter retreat, and starting in early January, where we will start to spend more time with formal practice, set aside duties, not have so many varying overnight visitors, just a steady crew, hopefully, and start to move, turn inward. At tea time today, Jessica was asking about seclusion, viveka, and what are some of the aspects about it, and how to encourage it or engender it in one's life, particularly when one has a busy life with a lot of engagement, stimulation, family, in her case, and all sorts of activities that need attending to. How to work with the concept and the need for viveka, seclusion, and what does that actually mean? And ended up talking about some of the ways that one can view and experience viveka classically in the teachings. Three kinds of viveka are described: kaya viveka, citta viveka, upadhi viveka. Kaya viveka, seclusion of the body or with the body. Citta viveka, seclusion of the mind, roughly translated that way. Upadhi viveka, seclusion from, it's kind of a word that's not used a whole lot, but upadhi, sometimes translated as like the constituents of becoming or the constituents of existence. I thought it'd be worth talking about viveka a little bit tonight, because that's what we're hopefully moving towards. So kaya viveka, seclusion of the body, is that opportunity that we take living in a forest, living outside the stimulation of the city, all the distractions and stimulation that one can experience from a busy, active outside world. Just the power, experiencing the power of living in a natural environment, the power of that environment just to help simplify and reduce the sensory load that is so pervasive in the world these days, just a constant level of sensory impingement that we experience in the modern, what we call the modern world. And, you know, what a privilege it is actually for us living here to have to actually walk 20 or 25 minutes or sometimes longer from the main area to our cabins, usually a couple times a day. And the privilege it is to be able to walk across up and down paths through the forest, just being surrounded by reminders of simplicity and nature, stillness, from the trees, the creeks, the different kinds of foliage, the grasses, and the animals that we come in contact with, the deer, and saw our first rabbit today that I haven't seen for a long time, running down the road in front of the headlights. The winter appearance of the jackrabbits, all the other critters, the birds, and just the natural soothing aspect of living in the forest. And being able to go to the roots of our trees, or the empty huts, as the Buddha admonishes us to go to the there are these roots of trees, there are these empty huts for us to go and experience some of this kaya viveka. And how, although not absolutely necessary for stilling the mind, how useful it is. Because the mind just naturally wants to calm down and settle in this kind of environment. If one looks around and listens to these qualities of the forest and the quiet dwellings for the afternoon abiding, tuning the external senses into this very relaxing, soothing environment, kaya viveka. It helps to settle the mind. The body and the mind are so closely intertwined. When the body starts to settle, the mind will also settle. Harder to do that out in the world, but finding times of day where there's a quiet room devoted to images that induce that kind of sense of stillness and peace, shrine, having our own shrines in our kutis or in rooms of a house if we're living in the city, and allowing that space and isolation from other people as much as one can feel comfortable with and as much as one can arrange, you know, having that do not disturb sign on our doors that just says time for some quiet, and using that space accordingly. As I was mentioning at tea time too, I think one of Ajahn Sumedho's realizations when he was first starting monasteries in the West was that the opportunities for kaya viveka were going to be fewer than they were in Thailand when he was there. Just starting a whole new venture, having to engage with people, having to educate the Western communities about what monasteries are all about, and then literally building them from the ground up. There wasn't going to be as much kaya viveka, so the necessity to find that sense of seclusion and quiet within the mind itself, citta viveka, most people would recognize that as the title of one of the first books of his reflections, and also, of course, the name of the monastery at Chitthurst, citta viveka, the silent mind or the secluded mind, seclusion of the mind. And what that points to, that sense of stillness, that place of quiet and non-engagement that we can find by turning inwards. And that quiet spot, of that still point. And classically in the teachings, that generally refers to seclusion from the five hindrances. So the process of stilling the mind is very much dependent on recognizing and turning away from the five hindrances, sensual desire, irritation or aversion, ill will, sloth, torpor, tiredness, fatigue of the mind, dullness, drowsiness really is a good translation, and the restlessness or anxiety, and the doubt that one can experience, the five hindrances, and recognizing, releasing them, and turning towards that stillness that comes as we let go of the pulls of the mind, the pulls of the habits of mind, allowing the mind to settle to that still point. This is a real place of refuge, particularly when there's a lot of stimulation or a busy environment. One has to be creative and look for that peace on the inside, and it can be done even in the midst of stimulation, engagement, but it takes attention and care and cultivation. It's not something that happens naturally or easily. And if you don't have the support of a natural environment, you have to turn more attention and put more emphasis on developing that internal sense with all the different strategies that one uses when one is more engaged in the world, particularly in a more urban setting. Really cultivating those places and times of quiet and withdrawal. But just because it's more difficult doesn't mean one shouldn't do it. One of the practices that the Buddha talks about to help along the line of citta viveka especially is also one of what's one part of what's called the apanika dhammas, the apanika, something that's always a good bet, something that's always appropriate and suitable in any condition, any situation. And there are several of those that are talked about, including moderation in eating and moderation in sleep. And one of the ones that's often talked about, it would be sense restraint. And the importance of trying to move towards that level of withdrawal, in a sense, from the world of the senses as a way of helping to still the mind and find that place of solitude or seclusion. Sense restraint not necessarily being completely withdrawn from sensory stimulation, although that certainly helps, again, with the seclusion of the body, the kaya viveka, so that one's, you know, the sensory input, particularly the very stimulating kinds of sensory input, the extremes that can be found for stimulating sensual desire or stimulating aversion or ill will, those just that actually removing oneself from situations is can help to reduce that level of sensory agitation. But we can't isolate ourselves from existence. Most of us have to just keep engaging in some way or another with the world around us. So learning how to develop that sense of sense restraint even while one is engaged. So it's not like we're trying to create sensory deprivation environments and close off everything so that we don't have to have any kind of impingement. The human body, human mind, is a sensitive organism, and there will always be some sort of impingement through the sense bases. So how to maintain a sense of restraint within that context is important. And the Buddha talks about real sense restraint, indriya sangwara, as not attending to the signs and features of a particular sense experience that are bound to invoke attachment, aversion, confusion. So not attending to them in the wrong way that leads one to agitation, movement of mind, craving for the experience or craving to get away. And it takes a skill to do that. One has to look with discerning eyes at the world around one so as not to be fooled by the different aspects of a sensory condition, sensory experience that greed, hatred, and delusion want to take a hold of. The desire to see things the way we want to fulfill desire, the needs of desire. We have this great ability to ferret out and see what it is that we want to see. And if desire or aversion are the predominant actors in the play, then they will direct how the mind goes out to an object and what it engages with to satisfy its purpose. So with sense restraint, we have to get wise to how that's happening and realize that we can attend to the world around us in a more skillful way that doesn't invoke play into the defilements, the mind that wants to go to an object and get it and attain some sort of temporary gratification. It's not that there isn't that gratification. And the Buddha says we need to know that. We need to know the gratification in the realm of the senses, because that's what it is that we usually respond to. We also need to, as part of this understanding how to restrain the senses, we have to realize what he would call the danger, essentially that no matter what it is, that gratification in the sense realm will always change. It has the nature to be impermanent, the nature to change. So we realize that it can provide something that's momentarily gratifying, pleasurable, and then rather than jumping to the next thing, we allow ourselves to experience the dissolution of that and the sense of disappointment when it starts to fade away. And then the escape, gratification, danger, and escape from that kind of delusion would be attending to it in this way that we're talking about, without attending to the signs and features that are fooling us into thinking that it's going to give us lasting pleasure. And we can train ourselves to see these experiences in a way that leads to dispassion, disinterest, disengagement, and with clear seeing. We see things as they are. We see how we are exaggerating through desire the attractiveness of some experience, in whether it's in the realm of sights or sounds or tastes, the ones that really grab us. And as we see them clearly in their true form, and sometimes we have to take stronger countermeasures, you know, to offset the natural tendencies. We have to sometimes consciously focus on some of the unattractive elements of these experiences, the downside, not as a way of creating revulsion or aversion, but as a way of countering the enchantment that we usually allow ourselves to fall into. Or the disadvantages of getting lost in anger and irritation, you know, watching when that happens, the consequences. What does the mind feel like after one gives oneself over to that kind of expression of anger or that repetitive proliferation in the mind about different unpleasant circumstances or people? What's the effect of that? And then to work with skillful ways to stop that from happening, to divert our minds to more skillful ways of looking at things, and developing a sense of patience and openness with those kinds of unpleasant things. Patience being a real strong practice in the face of aversion, irritation. So these are ways to reframe these experiences and not get pulled out into them. This is the way that we can really maturely use sense restraint so as not to completely get lost in engaging with the world around us. As we do that, as we develop this sense of sense restraint, not attending to those signs and features that pull us away from our still center, then that sense of viveka can start to grow, that sense of seclusion from the hindrances. And we, just through experience and reflection, become able to center and move towards that quiet sense of peacefulness that underlies all this activity. It just isn't so interesting anymore. The third kind of viveka, upadhi viveka, I had to kind of go and look just after tea and before puja at some texts to get a little bit of clarification, I had remembered it as seclusion from the constituents of existence, which is one of the ways it's used. And as I was looking at it, and Ajahn Yanako and I were talking about it, and he remarked, you know, about it, wondering if it was the same root as upadana, which it is, upadana for clinging, and that one of the ways that makes sense to me, that I think it's the commentaries expound on upadhi viveka, is that sense of seclusion from what we and how we attach to that creates a sense of becoming, existence. It refers to, actually, it can refer to the five aggregates affected by clinging, the upadana khanda, which we're familiar with, as the, you know, the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness under the influence of upadana clinging, and the formation of self that forms around those, that creates this sense of identity and this clinging as the precursor to becoming and existence, self-existence especially. So there is this kind of upadhi viveka, this seclusion that we can experience as we start to let go of the clinging that we have to the five aggregates. And that is one of the most beautiful kinds of seclusion that we can experience. It's a seclusion from that whole realm of seeing the world through the lens of me, mine, myself, and all the ways that that creates suffering in our lives. And one could probably argue that that's the supreme form of seclusion. You know, we can practice and experience the citta viveka with meditation, reflection, and letting go of the five hindrances, developing of the meditation practice, really sinking into and absorbing into the meditation object that gives us peace of mind, often the body, the breathing. And use that, of course, as a primary tool. And being aware that that is just it, though. It is a tool. It's a, as the Buddha says, it's a very, very much of a pleasant abiding here and now. But if we want to really experience a deeper form of peace of mind, of seclusion, then we need to start turning towards how to release ourselves from the clinging to the aggregates, clinging to what we normally think of as ourselves, our experience. And it's that kind of peace of relinquishment, that peace of letting go of that self-identification that is the deepest kind of peace. It's easy to get caught in absorption, meditation, because it's such a wonderful and necessary alternative to the gratification that comes from the sense world and is part of the path to true freedom. And it, you know, is to be developed and cultivated and enjoyed, and to be seen as a tool, as a means, not as the end itself. Because someday the conditions that support that kind of meditative bliss, that absorption, will change. Our bodies will become difficult to bear. Maybe we won't have the supportive conditions of quiet place, opportunities to be in retreat. And we realize that sometimes those supportive conditions for concentration and meditation and absorption aren't going to always be there. And so if that's completely what we've depended on for peace of mind, then we will feel the discomfort when that is not the case. So developing alongside that the deeper sense of peace that comes from insight, relinquishment, and really truly letting go of the clinging to that which we usually hold so dearly, that sense of me, that sense of myself, and all the ways we get wrapped up in that. And that that is the supreme kind of freedom and peace that we can experience. And that's the, you know, the freedom, that experience using the upadhi viveka to be able to develop and recognize that sense of disenchantment with staying involved with the constituents of existence, the dispassion, the realization that for true peace we don't need to do that anymore. We've done it enough. We've believed in the storylines that our hearts and minds have been telling us for too long, and that sense of wanting to relinquish, to let go, just becomes stronger and stronger, and we start to do it more and more in first little ways and then in more absolute ways. We were also talking at tea time about relinquishment and what that means and what that feels like. Is it the same as letting go? And it has that same flavor of letting go. Talking about the line in the Dhammacakka Sutta where it talks about the release from that which causes suffering, the cause of suffering being craving in its various forms, which of course is the precursor to clinging, and the freedom that results from that very release of that craving, chago patinisago muti analayo, that sequence of movements to give up chaga, give over, hand over. Emotion I always like to think about is the sense of something in the hand that one is starting to open the hand slightly and move it towards giving, the giving gesture. But in this case, the giving up of all of our destructive habits that keep us engaged in samsara. So the chaga, the giving up, and the patinisaga, which is the actual relinquishment, the allowing it to move on, the passing over, and the fact that it's actually being let go of. And mutti, the relief, or the freedom, the liberation from that grasping, from that clinging, from that craving, the results from that, mutti, freedom, liberation. And anālayo, the detachment or non-attachment, so that when all these various experiences come through the mind, the temptations, the signs and features that we usually fall for, when they start to float through, we don't even feel the urge to pick them up at all. That non-attachment, anālayo, so that it's a complete removal from picking up those causes and conditions that lead to suffering in the long run. So this is the, you know, the potential for the ultimate result of practicing with seclusion of the body, seclusion of the mind from the hindrances, and seclusion from the grasping to all of what we consider to be ourselves and our experience. There is that potential for, as we do it little by little, the potential for it to grow and grow into, hopefully, at some point, a complete freedom from this suffering. So I think leave that for a few thoughts for tonight. Call it an evening. Okay, so tonight's the Lunar Observance Night. We have the opportunity to continue practicing through the evening and tea at midnight.